What's the dish? Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Food Safety Dish, a production brought to you by National Farmers Union's Local Food Safety Collaborative. I'm your host, Katherine Cavanaugh, and today Haley Wood and a few intern Kendall Johnson and I are joined by some pretty unbelievable guests at two different ends of the country, urban beekeepers from Detroit, Michigan, Timothy Paul and Nicole Lindsay at Detroit Hives, and Tara Chapman at Two Hives Honey in Austin, Texas. We'll discuss how pollinators fit into and enhance the fabric of an urban landscape, some consumer expectations of honey, and how food safety and security are tied to our small but mighty pollinators. But before we dig into the dish, I thought it would be helpful to share a little background on what a pollinator is and how they impact our food supply. There are a few terms in this episode that seem familiar but have important differences, so let's begin with a few definitions. A pollinator is any species that carries or transports pollen from one flower to another to fertilize plants, allowing them to reproduce. Bees get the bulk of the pollinator buzz, but other insects like beetles, wasps, butterflies, ants, birds, and bats are all very effective and important pollinators. A native pollinator is a pollinator whose species is found naturally in each area or region. Pollinators are critical to the flowering plant reproduction cycle. For instance, over 80% of the world's flowering plants rely on pollinators to act as a catalyst to fertilization. Pollination of flowering plants is important because these plants' reproduction cycle produces fruits, seeds, nuts, and vegetables. In fact, in the United States, one of every three bites of our food is made possible by pollinators. It is estimated that the total value of the ecological services provided by pollinators is upwards of $200 billion each year. Pollinators are an important part of a safe and stable food supply, and the work done by honeybees is notable. Of the 80% of flowering plants that require pollinators, honeybees are responsible for more than 80% of this pollination and responsible for 75% of the pollination of U.S.-grown fruits, nuts, and vegetables. Now onto our next definition, the honeybee. The honeybee we're all familiar with was imported from Europe in the 17th century and belongs to a family of social bees, meaning that it nests in colonies composed of a single fertile female leader, or queen, is run by female worker bees who forage for, feed, and clean the hive, and are repopulated by male drone bees. Female worker bees construct their hive by excreting wax and creating cells for honey and pollen storage. Some fun facts about honeybees are they produce 2 to 3 times more honey than is needed for survival and communicate by dancing in a figure-eight-like pattern. Honeybees tend to get a lot of the glory in being pollinators, but native bees actually do a lot better of a job at pollinating than honeybees. The issue is that native bees are rapidly disappearing. 3 species have already become extinct, and 4 other native species have declined 96% in the last 20 years. This decline in native bee population is due in part to human activity, but can also be attributed to invasive species. An invasive species is a non-native species that causes harm to the environment, economy, or human, animal, and plant health. This competition for shared resources from predatory and/or parasitic behavior, in addition to the chemical stressors and habitat loss, spell out an endangered and imperiled future for native bees. The colony collapse and disappearance of native bees and other pollinators like the honeybee are an important issue as they result in severe decline in the pollination of agricultural crops, leading to economic problems for growers and a potentially unstable food supply. You could say bees are a keystone species of our food supply, but the good news is that there still is time to turn this around. So we say, bees, please. Now let's get on to the buzz on today's episode. Keep this background in mind as we hear from our special guests on today's sweet dish. Detroit natives Timothy Paul and Nicole Lindsay are the founders and directors of Detroit Hives, a 501c3 nonprofit organization working to improve underserved communities for both people and pollinators by transforming vacant lots into educational green spaces. Founded in 2016, Detroit Hives now exists in over 29 locations, using the art of urban beekeeping to create a social, environmental, and financial impact. Through their Be the Change program, they educate thousands of inner city youth on the importance of pollinator conservation. Lastly, through their nationally recognized urban beekeeping model, Detroit Hives founded National Urban Beekeeping Day, celebrated annually on July 19th. Detroit Hive's proud memberships and associations include Southeastern Michigan Beekeepers Association, Michigan Beekeepers Association, Sustainable Beekeepers Guild of Michigan, American Beekeeping Federation, Certified Pollinator Champions of MSU Extension, and Bee Ambassadors of the Bee Conservancy. Tara Chapman is the founder and owner of Two Hives Honey. Tara started her career working in intelligence for the federal government, but a chance beekeeping class inspired her to quit her job and become a beekeeper. An accomplished speaker and educator, she is asked to speak and educate beekeepers across the United States each year and has taught thousands of beekeepers in her 10-year tenure. She has been featured on The Today Show, Vice Media, Amtrak's magazine The National, and others. Tara has an upcoming book on beekeeping from the University of Texas Press, expected in August 2024. Tara has a level one certification in honey sensory from the American Honey Tasting Society and a bachelor's degree from Duke University. Timothy, Nicole, and Tara, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us, and we're so glad you can be here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be a part of it.
Same. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Great. Well, let's get started with pollinators. What are they? What roles do they play? And how do bees differ from other pollinators?
So a pollinator is anything that can help transport seed from one flower to the next. So pollination can be done by wind, rain, gravity. But also, you know, you have pollinators that help contribute to cross-pollination. And a pollinator can be anything from ants to bats,
butterflies,
bees, etc. And they help transport seed from one flower to the next.
Yeah, I've always, Dr. Thomas Seeley, who's very famous in the world of beekeeping, he's done dedicated his life's research. And he once eloquently wrote that, think of bees and other pollinators as tiny penises moving sperm from one part of the plant to another. And I think that says it best.
So how do bees differ from other pollinators? Are they physiologically different, or what are maybe some similarities and some differences?
Yeah, well, all pollinators are built a little bit differently. Like there's some plants that are specifically designed and they've evolved alongside specific pollinators. So squash bees, for example, their body parts, they're designed to pollinate, you know, squash species of plants. Butterflies in particular have very, very long tongues. Honeybees don't have as long a tongues, which means that, you know, they can't access the nectar in a lot of plants. And nectar is what honeybees in particular are really after. The pollen's oftentimes is just, you know, almost accidental, though they do gather some pollen. They're mostly after nectar. And so that means they're not going to visit some flowers because they can't access the nectar. So different. And there's some native bees. Honeybees are not native to this country. They were brought here in the 1600s by European settlers. They're native to Europe, Asia, and Africa. But there's some species of our native bees, for example, that are a lot more, let's say, aggressive about collecting the pollen. They might chew holes through the back of the flower or even like headbang and shake a flower to shake the pollen loose. So they all have different attributes and traits that allows them to pollinate some plants better than others. So for example, tomato plants aren't really pollinated very well by honeybees. If you go to Iceland, you'll find greenhouses in the middle of the country where they just grow tomatoes, and they have dozens and dozens of colonies of bumblebees that are in the greenhouses just to pollinate these tomato plants. So they all, you know, work a little bit different depending on the plant and the species of pollinator.
So there are thousands of different kinds of pollinators out there. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's something like 22,000 different species of bees alone. I can't tell you how many species of bats or bats or butterflies or beetles or all the other kinds, but I mean, bees alone, over 20,000 species. So many, many, many different types.
Yeah, just to piggy bank, you know, Michigan is home to over 465 different types of species of native bees. And this was conducted by Michigan State University. They conducted what's called a bee census. So thanks to them, we were able to identify many different types of bees, a species ranging from bumblebees, leafcutter bees, mason bees, the list goes on. And you know, in the United States, we have well over 5,000. Of course, as mentioned earlier from Tara, there's over 20,000 species of bees in the world.
Mm-hmm. To their point, I love that Michigan State did that study. There's a dissension in the ranks here in Texas of whether or not we have seven species of bumblebees or nine species of bumblebees. And I like love people that want to sit around and fight about whether we should count them as seven species or nine species. But many, many, many species. And it's really fun to learn about them, and there is lots to learn about.
So, how do bees in particular factor into the ecosystem of a farm or urban environment?
With our honeybees, since they're a social insect and beekeeping has been a part of our culture for many, many, many years and centuries. It is one of the oldest professions that's been around. So, with honeybees, since they're in a large colony, they're known as a social type of bee. So their colony can grow from 10,000 all the way to 60,000 with one queen bee. And so with having such a mass and large colony, they're able to go out and pollinate large amounts of mass of produce, vegetables, and fruits.
Absolutely. And then in response to that, I would say Detroit is considered somewhat a green city. We have currently 24 square miles of vacant land. In most cases, that has not been returned to productive use. But in most cases, a lot of vacant land has been put to productive use in terms of urban gardens, apiaries, green projects, trails, and what we call as nature preserves as well. And doing so has been able to help support native bees. And we all know that the number one pollinator is the wild bees, the native wild bees. And they're very instrumental in helping to pollinate a lot of our fruits and vegetables to support food security. In addition to that, honeybees have been able to also thrive in urban areas because of plant diversity. There are tons of initiatives of people creating botanical gardens, introducing native and non-native flowers, and it somewhat created ecological balance between our native bees and our honeybees.
And I'll add to that as well. We have a lot of urban bees in the city of Austin as well. We do have several apiaries on some local farms. And the benefit to the local farms is that, a lot of farmers actually pay for pollination services. So when you hear someone say, without honeybees, we wouldn't have almonds. Well, that's not exactly true. We couldn't produce almonds in a monoculture style. So like in the US, the vast majority of our food, an overwhelming majority, is produced through monoculture, where you have one crop for many, many, many thousands of acres. And honeybees don't have to pollinate almonds. There's lots of bee species that can pollinate almonds, but you don't have enough naturally occurring bees in any area to pollinate that much unnatural level, the amount of crop, right? So in order to do that, farmers pay beekeepers who, there's brokers all over the country, and they work with beekeepers. And in fact, most beekeepers in this country, this is how they make their money. They send their bees, they start in California in January, usually on the almonds. And they do drive this big circle, and the honeybee colonies are driven around the US to pollinate these crops. So again, it's not that honeybees are biologically special that they have to pollinate these crops. It's that they're the only bee that we can pack on the back of semi trucks, and we can drive around in this fashion because that is how we grow our food. So they're very, very important for, food security in that sense, and that like we try to eat as local as possible, but it's really, really challenging to eat only truly local. And a lot, most all of the food at the grocery store is pollinated by bees that are driven around on semi trucks.
So interesting. And I think a lot of eaters aren't very aware of that fact. And we kind of touched on this briefly earlier, but could you explain a little bit more how the environment influences the type of beekeeping operation that you can run or the bees themselves? For instance, how perhaps like an urban versus a rural versus maybe something in between, how that affects the bees themselves and how that also affects what you could do with those bees.
Yeah, we have both urban bees and rural bees. I'm gonna guess the folks from Detroit Hives probably have a higher number of urban bees would be my guess. We have a little bit of both, But I have found in Austin, I'd be curious to hear their perspective, but in Austin, a lot of our city bees do far better than our rural bees. And that's shocking to people, but it's because in a lot of these areas, you know, in the city, you've got community gardens, you've got landscaping, you've got a lot of things that people are actively doing. Where in rural areas, you might have a lot of like natural forage for the bees, but you also might have large swaths of areas that at one point were farmed or are still farmed by cotton or monoculture crops that are not going to support native bees. Or at one point they were farmed that way, and now they're sort of like rural wastelands that have been taken over by invasive species, for example. So we do have some rural bees that do very, very, very well, but city bees sort of reliably often do better than our rural bees just because of the amount of forage. You know, honeybees in particular have to have access to large amounts of nectar, which is produced by flowering plants. And so, you know, if you don't have flowering plants, you're not going to be a successful beekeeper because your bees are going to be starving without that. So it can go both ways.
And just to piggyback on what Tara mentioned earlier, there's just a ton of plant diversity. And unfortunately, in some cases on most farms, you have what's called a monoculture where they may just have acres and acres of one particular crop. So a lot of bees will just have one source of pollen, whereas in some urban areas, you have many different type of plant sources that bees can get local groceries. Mm-hmm. And what we define as local groceries is, of course, our nectar, our pollen, mm-hmm. and water and propolis. And according to the Bee Conservancy, you know, urban bees have a winter survival rate of 62.5% compared to just 40% of rural bees. And urban bees produce almost twice as much as honey as rural bees. And that was information that was quoted from the Bee Conservancy. So to learn all about that, it's really interesting that it's one way that we can work together with urban and rural beekeepers to, I would say, plant different type of native and non-native wildflowers.
And then also, like a city like Detroit, we also have so many vacant land and spaces where it's allowing those native flowers to grow. So those clovers, dandelions, thistles, et cetera, are growing on top of people in the past who've had flowers and abundance of apple trees and other type of fruit trees. And there's no regulation of people like spraying here in Detroit as well. And a lot of people don't spend a lot of that extra to keep their lawns green. So nobody's really spraying chemicals like that here in the city of Detroit. So Detroit has become like this haven for bees and other animals in nature. There's so many things and animals that have come back to Detroit because of the environment, because we're not spraying. We're allowing those native flowers to grow and bloom and thrive. So it's attracting those native species to thrive more so in urban areas like cities like Detroit. And so U of M, University of Michigan, and Michigan State University have done studies showing that Detroit has been boosting native bee populations over the years. And then also Michigan is ranked number 4 with the most bee populations. So
isn't that amazing that the absence of humans in so many of these areas is like what allowed the bees to flourish? I want to share a story with you. I lived in D.C. for a really long time. And I know a lot of y'all's offices, Catherine, and your folks are in D.C. And my sister-in-law lives in D.C. And I'm back fairly often. I still own a place there. And I was visiting her last year. And, you know, in this country, we love lawns. It's like the most insane thing that we've sold, that we're going to introduce these non-native grasses that take time and energy and water, when if we did natives, we would just be in a much better spot. But I was in her little, she had tiny little, you know, in DC, we have these tiny townhomes, and she had this tiny little yard. And I said, wow, look at all that clover. And the like tension in the air was a little bit weird. Like things got a little bit awkward. And then like an hour later, she was like, I'm really embarrassed by my lawn. And I was like, no, I was complimenting you on all of this beautiful clover. It's so good for the bees. And she was like, so taken aback, because we live in a society where we value, unfortunately, lawns over letting all these natural, like, I love this idea of the local groceries you guys were talking about, instead of letting these local groceries that don't require like irrigation and pesticides to flourish, which would help the bees as well.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I feel like, and I feel, I have a lot of thoughts on lawns, but definitely like even thinking like just moving away from all the maintenance, all of the, you know, the inputs, there's a lot of pesticides, like it could be much more beautiful, you know, in my opinion. And I think that's amazing how it can really benefit the local wildlife. One question I have based off of what you all just said is, I wonder for the urban density, like, is it beneficial because like there's just like a lot of diversity of plants that are growing like within a small radius, like that you kind of get a little bit more in a city than you get in a more rural area? Or I guess I'm wondering, like, bees in the wild as it would be if it were untouched, like they can travel fair distances. So how does basically, I guess, like the density, like how close things are, or like how is it just kind of the advantages of having that like density of groceries for the bees that maybe exist naturally?
Yeah. Well, I think also it's important to note that not all urban areas are created equal in this sense. I think Detroit is a really, and I don't want to speak for you guys, but it seems that Detroit's a very unique city because they have a lot of the vacant lots that have allowed, you know, there's not a lot of lawns in a lot of these vacant lots when people have moved out, have allowed to flourish. Austin is also a particularly unique city. Like, there's lots of hives in New York City, but those hives don't particularly fare well because there is not a lot of, again, without nectar producing plants, you don't have bees that thrive. And so, you know, outside of like the Central Park area, like in Manhattan, bees are not going to do, bees are not going to do well. But in Austin, you know, which is a city, but it's sort of like this small town that somehow just like grew up really quickly, but you do have a lot of gardens and green space, tons of green space that have nectar and pollen producing plants that feed those bees. It's not going to be the same as it would be like in downtown Houston. You know, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like you said, like Detroit is a very unique city because of the so many vacant lots that we have, and not every city is reflective of that. So since we in this unique space, it gave us the opportunity to reserve those green spaces too as well throughout the city of Detroit, because it's not going to always be that way, because we do want to build, they do want to build up the city. But since we're in this space and we kind of have this voice for our bees and in nature, we can kind of put that out there. So when they're building up our city, that they'd be mindful to maintain these green spaces, and we maintain the spaces that we have and additional spaces just to make sure that these bees are still thriving and other insects as well.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting hearing different perspectives, especially because you guys are on basically different, totally different sides of the country geographically. Like, you know, it's quite cold in Michigan, and Texas has maybe just as much intensity, but with the summertime. And I want to talk a little bit about maybe your experiences and kind of expectations about being beekeeper. And before I came to NFU, I actually was beekeeping for a number of years, and that's how I kind of started my journey into food and farming. And, you know, I think about honeybees constantly, even if I'm just out in the field or in the grocery store. And beekeeping has definitely gained a lot of popularity in the last few years, I think, with messaging around their decline and just pollination importance in general. So this is a question for both of y'all. What are some incentives or disincentives for keeping bees? So pros and cons, I guess, of getting into beekeeping.
I think that, I think the concern that I have with a lot of people that get into beekeeping is that they get into it for the wrong reasons. I mean, we make a lot of our money off of educating beekeepers, so I want people to be excited about it. But for people that are here to make honey and they don't actually care about learning about bees or understanding, like, I think the beautiful thing about beekeeping, and again, when we're talking about beekeeping, we're talking about honeybees, a non-native species. It's really important for everyone to understand that. So when people come to me and they're excited about beekeeping because they want to learn more about the bees, and, you know, I always say, like, it's a super nuanced super organism. you know, they tell you to do Sudoku puzzles to keep your mind young, or you could just keep bees, because when you think you figured it out, they do something and you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. So it's mentally very challenging. And that's what makes it really fun to me. People that come to me and they just care about the honey, they don't care about anything else, they are not going to be successful. There's a lot of like misinformation come into this. People come into beekeeping because they want to, quote, save the bees. I mean, the media, I don't think it'll shock anybody, is oversimplified this issue a lot. You starting two hives in your backyard is not going to save the bees. I hate to say that. There's lots of things that you can do, but being a beekeeper can be really, really beneficial to you and raise awareness, and your friends, you're going to raise awareness because you're going to be excited. You're going to be talking about it. But when we talk about saving the bees, you really should be talking about saving our native species and looking towards how we can move our agriculture away from monoculture, because we're talking about saving a non-native species in a country where they're not native, right? So that's my big concern about people that are jumping into beekeeping. There's been this like backlash of like native bees versus honeybees, and we should stop talking about honeybees. At Two Hives, what we do is people are excited about honey and they're excited about honeybees. So why squash that excitement and miss an opportunity? We like to take those people in, educate them, and then also educate them about native bees. We do a ton. All of our education around native bees is free every year, and we do a ton of it. And, you know, and then the incentives for people is, of course, honey, but it should be far down on your list of priorities, because it's actually very challenging to produce honey. Depending on where you are in the climate, you're relying on live animals that require, you know, the climate to work just right to produce their only food source. It can be very tricky. But like I said, it's incredibly, the nuance and the challenges and the deep understanding that requires is what I think makes it super, super interesting. You know, there's never a boring day in beekeeping. It can be heartbreaking, but it's never boring. I can say that.
For us, you know, our story started with honey. You know, one of the synonyms of beekeeping is, I would say, healthy food options. You know, unfortunately, sometimes in our community, we have access to gas stations, fast food restaurants, and liquor stores. And a lot of our sources of food is laced with aspartame, high fructose corn syrup, beet syrup, artificial sweeteners, and is detrimental to a lot of our the health of our community. So by introducing a beekeeping operation, we can find ways to substitute those harmful sugars in our community. And that's how I was introduced into beekeeping, being sick, learning about local raw honey, and then wanted to provide that to our community. So that's one of the benefits or incentives, I would say, with beekeeping. Other than that, it's also with our urban farms. You know, of course, native bees are great, but in some areas, it's great to be able to create or introduce honeybee hives and also support those local farms as well. And as far as some of these incentives, I would say, it's just the management, you know, the things, the other parts that of beekeeping that most people don't really see or hear about is managing those hives, making sure that those hives are healthy, are strong going into the winter, the cost of managing them, the cost of overwintering them. It's a commitment that most people really are not prepared for, or they don't really see sometimes on social media. So there's a lot of stuff that's more required into beekeeping that, you know, that's that more than meets the eye.
Yeah, and to piggyback that Save the Bee initiative too, as well, is that a lot of people, like Tara mentioned, is that people think like, oh, save the bees, you're gonna save them with the honeybees. What the honeybees has allowed us to do is kind of measure what's going on with our native bees. So if we see like, oh, something's going on with the honeybees and they be dying off and things like that, now this gives us a kind of an eye-opening to what's going on with our native bees. And what people need to do if they want to be more so in helping or saving the bees is to plant more flowers, plant more diversity of native flowers to your area. So people really want to like be a part of saving the bees as one aspect, but beekeeping is one aspect, but planting, making sure we have a diverse ecosystem of flowers that bees can visit. Bees need at least 3 sources of nectar types to survive. So having those monocultures are not good for their diets. Yeah.
I'm so glad you both brought up the messaging around Save the Bees and this kind of idea that it's a very linear track in beekeeping, when in actuality, and from both your responses, like, it takes a lot of different sides of consideration to make it work. You know, there's the planting aspect, there is the hive management, there's the community elements. Yeah, and like Tim said, there's just way more that meets the eye. So it feels good to hear you both share your experiences in that. And I've got some specific questions for you both. So I'll start with Detroit hives first. So y'all have previously mentioned that Detroit has an abundance of green space and it's kind of ideal for this urban pollinator habitat. And I want to know your experience about how your work in beekeeping has affected the greater Detroit community and what some of your observations, you know, between residents and their relationships with their food, pollinators, the land, how any of that has changed, or, you know, just some of your observations from being in that space.
That's a great question. You know, Detroit is the place to be. When we first presented the idea of transforming a vacant lot to a bee farm, many of some of the policies, or I would say some of the departments, told us no. They were kind of afraid of the potential risks of people in the community being stung, just some of the risks that involves keeping bees.
Swarms,
things of that nature. Mm-hmm. However, we did it anyway. We did it with the help of the community. So mm-hmm. we started with our very first project, the East Warren Apiary, in 2017. And fast forward, we now exist in over 29 locations. But we also received a Spirit of Detroit Award from the City of Detroit, recognizing our efforts on working with community and beekeeping. And that's one thing that we brought different, I would say, to the urban beekeeping community, is infusing people with pollinators. A lot of times when you think about beekeeping, it was something viewed as something in a rural area, something that you place your bees in the back, and you really don't find a way to involve it with the surrounding. We did the completely opposite by offering tours, community engagement, involving places where we can learn about pollinators with the community as well.
So as us doing so, when we taken on, I want to piggyback on that. When we took over the vacant lot, so the residents were happy that somebody was coming in and activating those spaces, because it was an eyesore. People were dumping on those sites. So when we came, when we took over those vacant lots, we were able to clean up those spaces. So it was about beautification of the community that we were doing. And then that kind of started as a conversation to help them get over their fears of what they thought were bees. So like with the wasps and the yellow jackets and the community calling them bees and getting the two mixed up. So as we clean up the lot, that kind of allowed for the educational part to come in and introduce them to how beneficial honeybees are to, you know, the environment.
And just say, in addition to working with schools, local businesses, and corporations, where they can play their part in learning more about pollinators. Mm-hmm. So through our Bee to Change program, we educate and inspire the next generation of leaders on sustainability. We introduce them to beekeeping, the basic of biology of bees, and then also provide hands-on tours. We were instrumental in offering tours in the city of Detroit. Since 2017, we hosted well over 1,500 tours to educate the students on pollinator conservation and to help ease those fears and misconceptions around bees and pollinators.
Yep. So doing tours with all ages and educating. And also our sites also serve as pollinator habitats. So there are habitats for our native bees, as well as our butterflies and other native insects to thrive as well. So people get a chance to actually come in and actually see them on the flower and take pictures and engage. And we can educate them about those as well.
And then since then, it's like the bug, or I would say the love for the bees, kind of spread it. You know, our story went viral from there, and we've been able to inspire many people locally, nationally, and even internationally to take on similar missions. We've even been able to expand nationally with Mohives KC out in Kansas, Missouri, and that led us to start and found National Urban Beekeeping Day, which is celebrated annually on July 19th.
And also through our work too, like Tim mentioned, is that other organizations are actually taking on green spaces as well. So maintaining those and doing gardens and
community engagement around vacant lots.
Yeah.
It's like the city now has a green initiative. They have a beautification grants where they work with residents and nonprofits to transform vacant lots into green projects, but also involving the community. So our model has been recognized locally, nationally, and internationally to create that social, that environmental, and financial impact.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. It's very community oriented. And I think similar to the last question asked is that when you step into the Hive space, it can be really infectious and it can show you something that you don't usually see in day-to-day life, which can be really inspiring for people. And I always thought that, you know, in the times when I would bring newcomers, it was always a gateway to other things, whether that is a community piece or a food piece or, you know, what have you. But thanks for sharing your experiences about the Detroit community and just some of the engagement that beekeeping inspires.
Yeah, honeybees have been our gateway bug to a lot of things.
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't know how to explain it, but if you've ever been around a bunch of beekeepers, you start to feel the energy that emits just from, you know, a few thousand insects. It's a pretty wild it's a pretty wild practice.
The buzz.
I want to pivot. Yeah, it's a buzz. Literally. It creates a buzz for sure. And I want to ask Tara about honey. You know, we previously talked about some things about being a small business owner and being honey production based. You had actually brought to our team the fact that there's no US certified organic honey by the USDA. And we found that so interesting. We did some research about that. Could you discuss your honey operation and just, you know, what demand is like, what consumers expect, what your pain points are, and what the honey focus is like for you?
Yeah, I mean, one of the pain points that I think we've done a very good job at is education. I mean, if you just walk down the grocery store aisle and take a look at the cost of a pound of honey, it is shameful. It is shameful what the U.S. market, how low it's supporting. So we've had to do a lot of education to make people understand why you should be paying more and be shopping differently for honey than you are. People don't think about it as an ag product, but it's an agricultural product that people, farmers, beekeepers or farmers have to produce. And most all of that honey on the shelf, I mean, we're in 7 Austin area Whole Foods, right? So like not everything on the grocery store shelf is going to be in this category, but most all of it is not produced by U.S. beekeepers. Even if it says the name of a city on a jar on that shelf, that does not mean that was produced in your area. Most all of those companies are what are called honey packers. And what that means is they buy honey generally from Brazil, Canada, and Mexico, and they put it together. And that is why when you walk down the grocery store aisle, it appears that honey is a commodity. Cheap, all the same color, flavor, texture, when in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. When honey is harvested in batches that allow you to taste the floral sources that the bees visited to produce that honey, there is a rainbow of honeys. I mean, it can come super sweet, but it also can come in super, super bitter, from, you know, water white to almost black. And so this variance, again, is produced by different flowers. But when you mix it all together, all the grocery store honey is what's called blended. And when it's all blended together, you get this kind of like, you know, commoditized like color and flavor and texture. And so overcoming this notion that honey, you know, when people tell me I don't like honey, I always chuckle, because saying I don't like honey is just such a generalized statement. It would be like saying I don't like beverages, right? Honey can come in as many colors, flavors, and varietals as you would find in the beverage aisle at the grocery store. So that's a big one. I think we've done a very, very good job there. And then second to that, being a honey producer in the U.S., I mean, there's a reason that people don't produce honey as their main source of revenue, because it's really hard. It's much easier to just buy from beekeepers in other countries. You know, if Mexico doesn't have a good season, no big deal. I'll just buy from Canada this year. Things didn't go great from Canada beekeepers. Whatever, I'll just buy from Brazil, right? I am reliant on the weather patterns and ever-increasing erratic weather patterns with climate change and live animals to produce my main source of revenue. So it's very, very, very hard, which is why my honey is way more expensive than anything that you're going to find at a grocery store. But it's also way better. I mean, my diehard fans will tell you, like, you know, I had a woman this morning say, my husband just eats that cheap stuff, but I would not eat anything but Two Hives. I'm not doing anything differently than anyone else is. You know, any small beekeeper has got the practices that we do, right? It's just you don't see that very often. You really got to go to a farmer's market or, like, literally know your beekeeper. You know, this know your farmer thing, knowing your beekeeper stands true as well. So that is the trickiest thing about producing honey, is the education of getting people to believe and know that honey is not a commodity and that you should be paying more for it and that quality matters. And then having to deal with, you know, we cut our wholesale program for 2 years in a row because we had a devastating storm in February of 2021 that rocked Texas. We had no power or water for over 10 days, which, you know, wasn't that cold. Like, my friends in Detroit would laugh at the temperatures here that we had. But you got to remember, this was in February in Texas. Like, spring had already sprung. It would be like this storm happening in May, you know, up north. And so it rocked us. And then we had the worst drought that we've seen in decades the next season. So we had to cut our wholesale program because we had so little honey. I can't afford to sell, you know, wholesale to a Whole Foods when we have so little honey. So those are the really challenging aspects. And we also do a ton of agritourism education, you know, hive tours, honey tastings, honey harvest parties. And that is what pays the bills when the honey doesn't. And the nice thing is that people that are excited about our honey want to come out and see how it's made. They want to understand the process. And so people can come out and can see the process and then get the honey straight from the source. And that's really fun.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, there is kind of this illusion that happens at the grocery store, and it really erases a lot that what goes on behind the scenes of smaller operations and smaller producers. And, you know, I don't think people understand that when you're buying from a good from like a local farm or a producer directly, you're not just paying for the product, you're paying for the labor, the care, the production, the shelter, like all of those things are factored in. And we don't necessarily get that education. I think that's definitely a hurdle in agriculture as well.
And you're paying a premium because you know that those animals will treat it with like the respect that they deserve. And
absolutely.
We have moral ethical practices, and we, you know, manage our bees organically, and we're doing as much as we can to make sure that the product is safe for your family as possible, and that the animals that are used to produce that product are treated fairly.
Well, yeah, I think speaking of safety, that will be a good segue into maybe some questions about beekeeping and food safety.
Yeah, I love how you talk about the rainbow of honey. I think that's really interesting. I remember when I was living in Seattle going to the farmers markets, and they had an urban beekeeping project where you could try little toothpicks of honey from all these different zip codes. And I thought that was the first time I had ever experienced that. And I was like, wow, how interesting that, like, you can really taste how different these places that are like maybe a mile away, these hives, you know, like how they really differ. And it kind of like makes me think what you're saying, like it's in a lot of ways like a reflection of the landscape and of the environment and just like the rain, like what's going on there. So with that in mind, my question is, how do you view bees and other pollinators as tied to food safety and also more broadly food security? This can be anything from like views around pesticides, produce, vegetable production, or honey, or anything in between.
We believe a healthy future for bees pretty much reflects a healthy future for humanity. You know, if your bees are healthy, they have the right conducive environment where they can get access to local, diverse selection of food. That in turn is a reflection of your community and environment as well. That also relates to those particular food sources not being contaminated by insecticides or pesticides. So if your area where you are hosting honeybee hives are free from insecticides and pesticides, that also determines the quality of your food as well, your food safety, what's around your surrounding as well.
Yeah, that's such a great point. Like, bees are almost like barometer or thermometer, maybe is a better way to describe it, of like what's happening environmentally, right? From like, again, I mentioned these like erratic climate change patterns are not good for anyone in ag, anyone producing food, from like a backyard gardener to a local farmer to, you know, the larger, you know, big ag folks in big ag, right? Not great for anyone. And so, yeah, how the bees are doing is really a reflection of like environmentally how things are going, from climate change, pesticides, availability of food sources, etc.
I think that's even a more interesting point too when you think about gut health, because honeybees really suffer from gut challenges because of available forage, and you know, sometimes the diet can really influence how they're able to carry themselves and what they're able to produce. There's a lot of ties between humans and bees. They're kind of like the canaries in the coal mines, just these little species can tell us so much about our own society.
Yeah, like a lack of dietary diversity, right? If, exactly. You know, we've introduced so many invasives to this country. I mean, in Houston, there's this ongoing battle between beekeepers and environmentalists and gardeners about the presence of an invasive species of plant that produces a lot of nectar. And so bees make a lot of honey off of it, but it's super invasive and takes over. And I find it very, very interesting that people that purport to be, you know, I'm all about honeybees, right? But like, first and foremost, we need to be protecting our natural landscape and environment. And it's a great example of how beekeepers can put blinders on, and they will just fight to the death against any legislation that calls for, you know, destruction of this invasive species that crowds out all of our natives. It's good for our soil and all of our native bees, because that produces a lot of nectar and makes them a lot of honey.
There are definitely some politics behind beekeeping as well. And y'all have both definitely talked about the idea and messaging behind saving the bees. And also I've shared some threats that are relevant to your home state. So, you know, how, as beekeepers and stewards of native species, how do we grow a food system where health of people, pollinators, and ecology is prioritized? So this can just be a reflection, imagination. Yeah, how do you see that?
I think it's a really challenging question for me personally. I care so deeply about people having access to locally produced food that's free from pesticides and is like its most nutritional value and at an affordable price. And I care so deeply about the ecology and native plants and native species. And I just care so much about all of this, but I am one person and I do not have these answers. And I, you know, when I come across farmers who are like, I want to be a beekeeper, I'm always like, but do you, you know, I appreciate that you want to do all of the things, but we are but one human and we have families and like, hopefully I don't have much of a social life now that I have a 2-year-old and 2 businesses, but like, you know, we're only one person and we just can't do it all. And so I believe very strongly in education in general, just like getting people to care. I think apathy is going to be the downfall to our society if we're speaking like philosophically. I can't handle apathy. Like, just care about something. You know, if you want to like fight about 7 species versus 9 species of bumblebees, I am here for it. Let's do it because you care. So I just feel very strongly about like education and getting people to find something that they care about. And like, I care very deeply about all of it, but I can only focus on this one tiny small piece, and I'm going to educate about this one tiny small piece, and hopefully, you know, someone else can take care of the other things. I just believe in just like people caring. If we can just convince people that they should care, I just think so many people just get up and go to work every day and kind of, I just want people to care about something and affect some amount of change in any way, small or large. Does that make sense?
Apiary is not apathy.
Yeah, it makes sense. We have to have a hive mind, right? So when everybody is playing their part, so imagine the world is just like a hive, a honeybee hive, and all the honeybees, the worker bees, have a certain job that they do to keep that hive thriving. So we have to think about that. So like, you know, you'll do this part, maybe you'll care about the water, or maybe you'll care about what's going on with our plants and our flowers. Maybe you'll do something else or something else. But like you said, yeah, we can't do it all, you know, by ourselves. If everybody takes a little bit and care and do a little bit of this and that, and then that'll help the world become a better place, right?
Right. And, you know, the question is, how do we prioritize the health of our food systems for people and pollinators? You know, it's through our mission. You know, it's one way that we found one way is that we work to improve underserved communities. People in the community, they have an issue with blight. They have an issue with trash in the neighborhood. They have an issue with a public health concern. You know, so we find ways to address that by reimagining these vacant landscapes to address pollution, to address blight, but also introducing more green infrastructure to attract more pollinators that in return provide education and conservation services as well.
Yep, and hoping that that inspires somebody to continue to do the next part. So inspiring the next generation. So when we have kids that come and visit us and youth, we're not necessarily inspiring them to be beekeepers, but
change agents
to do something in the environment, yes. To just inspire them, just to spark that little spark in their mind. So
yeah, I think sometimes we, and when I say we, I'm speaking of like the royal we, like can be our own worst enemies. I was in a meeting last week with a very group of people from like city officials to like a lot of different groups. And I'm on this committee and we were looking at sending out these like brochures that talk about like creating a pollinator garden, right? And we argued for way longer than I want to even talk about like adapted versus native versus invasive. Like we can all agree that invasive is bad, but like are adaptive plants okay? Like just argued for such a long time about like, just get the word out, just get people excited to plant for pollinators. Like I just, you know what I mean? I think people that care sometimes can like just get so far into the weeds and can forget about the bigger picture. And so I'm so thankful to be in the company of the folks like you folks over at Detroit Hives, where like you, the bigger picture is what we all want to focus on, right? We just want to keep moving forward. That's what's most important.
Thanks for sharing those reflections. I'm hearing a lot about obviously care, imagination, cooperation. I think those are big highlights of your responses. How do y'all see, you know, how can farmers or neighbors support local bee populations, whether that's native or honeybee?
The number one thing people can do to support native bee populations is plant native wildflowers. Find your local native floral nursery and buy some native wildflowers. You can also
I was gonna say plant it and they will come. Yeah. But go ahead.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, supporting your local farmers, your local producers, be that a beekeeper or a rancher or a farmer, because generally speaking, like your local small producers are the ones that have dedicated their lives to producing food in a really hard way. And when I say really hard, I mean relative to like monoculture, for example, right? Like it's far easier to just go out and spray pesticides indiscriminately than it is to do an integrative pest management plan, right? And so supporting those folks that have dedicate their, you know, far more than their 9 to 5 every day to producing that good food, supporting them, they have a megaphone, right? Like for us, we are not nonprofit, we are for profit, but we do a ton of education at Two Hives, you know, like this, for example. And so if you're supporting us, you're getting not only like a really good product, but you're also supporting our efforts to continue to make sure that like the next generation cares and understands why this all matters.
Yeah, and you both have pillars of education in your operation. So what advice do you have for people, specifically farmers or growers, looking to incorporate bees maybe into their farm, their lifestyle? You know, what are the steps you like to get people curious and to get them into the beginning steps of education?
We like to educate farmers and growers that they don't have to house honeybees at their site. As long as they plan plant diversity, they can track native bees. And we also educate them that native bees like mason bees are more effective than honeybees. Like one mason bee can do the job of 8 honeybees or more because they're just a little bit more, they're not as neat and tidy as honeybees. So we always educate them that native bees are a little bit more effective than honeybees. If you're looking for cross-pollination services, that is.
Right. So if you plant more diverse of flowers instead of just having monocultures, then that'll attract those native bees to help come pollinate those food sources that you're growing.
Yeah. So like I was mentioning earlier, I have a lot of farmers that come to me and they do want to incorporate bees for a myriad odd of reasons. That could be for an ag valuation, because unfortunately in the state of Texas, like, you don't get an ag valuation for your land except for those acres that you were actually planting crops. Doesn't make a lot of sense. But it could be for the ag valuation or for pollination or just like a personal interest. And I'm all about people look wanting to learn beekeepers, but like I say, I do encourage them to think about that if that's they have the time and the space and the energy for that. You know, if they're already engaging in a full-time farming operation, it can be, it's for the same reason that I don't have a garden. You know, I grow a lot of pollinator seeds and plants that like don't require anything from me. They reseed themselves every year and I mow them at the right time and I don't do anything else because I just can't take them anymore. So for those folks, I encourage you, if you really are interested in having, you know, again, honeybees on your property, looking for local beekeepers and maybe and doing a partnership there. And then everyone again gets to kind of focus on, because beekeeping is not easy. It's incredibly nuanced and it can be very challenging to be successful. And so partnering with a local beekeeper, I think, can be a really, really great way, again, to cross-pollinate as you know, y'all were just talking about. So that's what I encourage people to do.
Thanks for sharing those.
Yeah, and to piggyback off that, yeah, definitely join beekeeping associations or Facebook groups or some type of group and try to find you a mentor that way. Because, like she mentioned earlier, it takes a lot of work and a lot of commitment. So if you have somebody who's already doing it or done it to help you through the way, then that'll be the best practice, is to join like an association, and then you have a plethora of what you need, the bees, the equipment, and the information.
And or volunteer for a local apiary. If you know a beekeeper, volunteer to assist them and you get a hands-on experience right then and there. And that will determine whether, you know, you want to move forward with it or not.
Yeah, learning from an experienced beekeeper is, there's no replacement from like standing alongside an experienced beekeeper if you can find one. It's the best way to learn.
Yeah, it seems like the best message here is to just don't go in blind and, you know, try to find folks who can help guide you through those early steps of understanding what your intention is with working with bees. Yeah.
I want to give Kendall an opportunity to ask any questions that she might have for our guests today.
You guys had such a great conversation that you actually answered my two original questions. But one that I came up with while you guys were talking was, you talked a little bit about how honeybees are sort of trekked around the nation to pollinate different things. What is that interaction like between those honeybees that aren't native to those areas with those native bees? Do they kind of work cooperatively to get all the pollination done? Or do you see sort of a competition for nectar and those local groceries you were referring to?
honeybees compete against honeybees.
Yeah.
You know, we introduce botanical gardens and pollinating habitats. We don't have an issue with our honeybees and our native bees. We've been having an issue with Will Carter bees. And then we've been having an issue with our honeybees competing against other honeybee colonies, either our own or surrounding honeybee colonies, but never with native bees. The number one issue, I'll say the number one issue with our native bees or wildlife is a lack of habitat. We've done away with our natural roads, our freeways. We created freeways and highways and communities and displaced our native bees, our wildlife, and et cetera. So one way we can really address this issue is by really supporting our native habitats, but also maybe incorporating a few non-natives. That helps as well. I know there may be some that's against the non-natives, but they do help in some instances if you have honeybee hives.
Yeah, because we've seen with our own eyes at our pollinator habitats. So like at our pollinator habitats are pretty much
dominated
by our native bees. And so we won't see any of our honeybees. It might be like a little handful, but it is dominated by our native bees. The honeybees will fly out further to look for nectar and pollen, so they don't compete with one another that we've seen. Like Tim mentioned earlier, we've seen honeybees and honeybees compete with each other, but we haven't seen our natives and our honeybees compete with one another. The only one that we've seen is that Will Carter bee, and that's because that Will Carter bee is taking over a plant because it wants to show that female, hey, I have this whole area of flowers, so I'm going to fight and tussle with any other bee that comes this way because I'm trying to attract this female. But that's the only issue that we've had is with the Will Carter bee. Other than that, we haven't seen that. And it's the funniest thing because that Will Carter bee would like attack and like flip that bee. And I'm like, wait, there's enough flowers here for everybody, so please stop. Share.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there's a finite amount of resources in any system, right? There's only so much of everything. And so when you look at it from that sense, you know, there's only so many flowers with so much nectar and so much pollen. And so there is a finite amount of resources. And so in that sense, you know, I would say that there's competition. But to the point that they were just making, it's oftentimes you don't see them visiting the same types of flowers. So like all of our salvias, our honeybees don't really visit, but man, our bumblebees and our carpenters love it. So that is not the case for all floral sources for sure. But a lot of times you do see native bees on plants that the honeybees just kind of ignore for lots of reasons related to biology and how hard they have to work, you know, all those things that I mentioned earlier. But the nice thing is that when you educate someone on what to do to support a honeybee, you're educating them. It's the same things to support that honeybee, that native bee, that butterfly, you know, the beetle, all the other pollinators. Like when you learn what you can do to support one type, it kind of applies to all of them. There are certainly plants that are better suited towards some species or another, but generally speaking, the message is the same. Also to the point of honeybees are vicious towards each other. I mean, they will rob another colony to death. It's like they are designed by nature to be hoarders. Mm-hmm. Because unlike in native species, we're only, you know, they don't have colonies of many, many thousands of bees to have to feed year round. In the honeybee colony, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 bees could overwinter. There are a lot of mouths to feed. And so there's never a point where they stop and they go, ah, we've stored all the food we need for the year. Let's take a break. That doesn't exist in honeybee colonies. They will hoard and, again, fight to the death if they can find another colony that they can take over to steal. And our colonies will steal from one another. So they're pretty vicious. It's something that a beekeeper has to think very carefully about, particularly here in Texas where we have such severe droughts and dearths where no food is available.
I have seen crazy hive robbing in Texas summers and, you know, even in other seasons. And it is a very cool, but a very scary thing to watch. And like something can set it off, you know, so little. It is a crazy phenomenon though. But yeah, when you see those honeybees go, they do not stop.
I know, I've seen, and like robbing is like a very sort of frenzied sort of activity at the entrance to the hive, but also is food gathering. And mm-hmm. I have seen so many beekeepers that send me a video and they're so excited. They're like, look, my bees are so busy. And I'm like, oh dear. Your colony might be dead because that is robbing. That is not what you want to see. But just one of the many nuances of like being a beekeeper, like learning what's robbing versus what's mm-hmm. actually foraging.
Mm-hmm. You know, when we first started beekeeping, we learned some ways to mitigate robbing. One is, of course, an entry reducer or different types of way to shorten the entrance. Mm-hmm. But another way we learned is by rubbing Vicks Vapor Rub around those beehives. And what that does, it masks off that sweet smell from visiting wasps or visiting mm-hmm. honeybees that's trying to rob those hives. But the honeybees that belong to that particular hive can smell through that scent, because what they're looking for is the scent of the queen. And they can smell through that scent of the Vicks Vapor Rub, you know, to report back to that hive. Versus a worker bee that does not belong to that colony.
Yeah, so we've used Vicks Vapor Rub to kind of mitigate that first year that we had that problem, and it actually works. So. Yeah.
Works really well.
Yeah.
Wow, fascinating.
Yeah, most robbing is actually beekeeper created. All right, all of it is that a beekeeper's in a hive. Has a like a box, what we call a super open with honey, just sitting out in the open, and that's what causes most of the robbing. And then here in Texas, we have such severe periods of drought. I mean, that's like throwing blood in the water where sharks are. Mm. It's just, and it's really hard once it starts to get it to stop. It can be overwhelming.
And that's what it looks like too. I've definitely made that mistake for a few years, inciting a robbing incident. When we were at the university hives, and I'll never forget it, that's for sure. I'll never make that mistake twice.
Well, yeah, so during darth season, don't be in your hives for a very long time. Go in and out. Especially, you gotta know what you're looking for and getting out of those hives mm-hmm. during those darth season, because you can't break that. If you break that seal off that honey, you best believe Helpless. If you got a weak honeybee hive, those robbers are coming from that, for that product.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we talk about, I will argue with anyone to the death that beekeeping is the hardest form of agriculture that exists, because I can't think of another form of ag that you rely on live animals and plants both, right? Like, of course, like cattle will graze, but like if there's nothing to graze, you can supplement. That's something that you can do. You can't feed honeybees sugar water or keep them alive, but it's not going to make honey. And so it's one of the reasons that I will like argue to the death that beekeeping is the hardest form of agriculture. Also, it's the only form of agriculture that I know that the animals will fight like hell to take that product back. And so when you're out harvesting, you know, when you pull the honey supers, the boxes of honey off the hives, and you don't keep it covered, and you go inside to take a phone call and you forget and you come out, your honey will be gone and then just take it back.
Also, I like to touch on sometimes when maybe dealing with a hive and you deal with a lot of stingers in your glove, in your beekeeping glove, and you were to sit that glove somewhere or a bee were to sting you, those recycled stingers are still active and they can still prick you. So it's like having little tiny knives around in your glove or in your car. And I've been stung many times accidentally by just a stinger being left around in a glove and it just re-punches you again.
Wow.
It's like little tiny knives.
Yeah, and I find that the like dead stingers, meaning like a stinger that is removed from a beekeeper's abdomen, actually hurts way worse than being stung. I don't know the biology behind that, but they hurt way worse. Yet another reason that beekeeping is the hardest for that.
Right? You're not expecting it. So beekeeping is a commitment. Yeah. So those listeners out there, be committed and ready to work. It's a great, we love it.
Yeah.
You know, it comes with the rewards, but be prepared for the commitment.
Wow. I feel like I've garnered so much more respect for beekeepers just in this brief conversation. Well, finally, I have one more question. Are there any other fun facts about bees that you would like to impart to our listeners before we end our conversation, anything either, you know, public facing or farm facing, what don't people know about bees?
That bees can recognize your face, your voice, and your scent.
Oh my gosh. For better or for worse, maybe.
I think more so an informative fact that bees do get stressed out. You know, many people don't know that. Bees can work, forager bees can get stressed out. So by sometimes planting lavender can help make a bee or a forager bee job less stressful. Also, bees depend on sunlight. You know, they have five eyes. They have two large compound eyes made of 7,000 lenses, and they have three eyes on top of their head called their simple eyes. So they depend on sunlight for navigation, for finding a way to and from the hive. And also, the slightest thing is cloudy weather or can make it really challenging or difficult for them to find a way back home. But also, the slightest thing is a raindrop can potentially break a bee's wings that they're out foraging as well.
Wow.
There's so many bee facts that are really fun. But the first one that comes to mind, well, I'll share two with you, more on bees' eyesight. Honeybees can see every color that humans can see, except for the color red. They see red as sort of like a gray or grayish color, but they can see in the UV spectrum. And so they have a whole spectrum of colors that we just cannot see. So many flowers have like secret hidden messages that if you shine a UV light over, you can see these kind of markings on the flower that help guide the bee to where the food is in the flower. And then the last one that is often repeated, but I think it can always be mentioned again, is that one honeybee will only make 1/12 a teaspoon of honey in her lifetime. And it just really like hits home. Like we sell these little pendants in our store that have that amount of honey to remind people that that's the amount of honey that will go into one entire bee's life's work.
Wow. Such a noble little creature, just buzzing away, making honey, serving the hive or the queen. That's so interesting. Thanks so much for sharing.
Absolutely.
Thank you all so much for sharing your expertise and your observations. It's been lovely to hear y'all in conversation and just find some similarities and some new discoveries. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really cool to chat about this subject with y'all.
Yes, thanks so much for joining us, and I really think this will be a very exciting episode for people to listen to, and hopefully they'll learn a lot more about bees. I know I have, that's for sure.
Oh, is there anything y'all want to plug for your organization before we wrap up?
I had something pretty exciting, but it's a little bit time sensitive. It's an ongoing grant, but we recently won a grant in conjunction with the local Texas university. It is a USDA grant, and the grant allows us to offer beekeeping education to BIPOC and veteran communities for free. And so that includes both online beekeeping course, so that's anyone can take that, you know, no matter where you are, but also we're able to offer our intensive 50-hour beekeeping course here in Texas. So of course that would be only for folks that were more local. But it's worth mentioning, that grant is ongoing for several years, but kind of once the funds are expended, they're expended. But if anyone's interested, following us on social at, Two Hives, spell out the two, T-W-H-I-V-E-S is the best way to learn about it. And that's a more immediate, thing that people can apply for now.
I think for us, just we encourage people to join the hive and follow us on social media. You know, we are a nonprofit, so we're always looking for volunteers, in-kind donations, and of course, monetary donations as well.
Mm-hmm. And we're all going to go out and plant some native wildflowers while we're at it, too. And I know I will.
Yeah. Oh. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. What was no. you supposed to say? Oh, and then we mentioned this earlier, but I was thinking about National Urban Beekeeping Day, but I don't know if we should
Oh, well, you should still, you should hype it. That's so cool you guys made that happen. Don't forget to celebrate National Urban Beekeeping Day on July 19th. All right. Well, thank you again. This has been so wonderful. I can't wait for everybody to listen.
Same here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yep.
Of course.
Same. Yes.
Thanks for being here, y'all.
Yep. Be well.
Yes, be well.
Be well, everybody.
The Local Food Safety Collaborative is a cooperative initiative established between the National Farmers Union Foundation and the FDA with the goal of providing training, education, and technical assistance to local food producers to ensure good food safety practices and compliance with the Food Safety Modernization Act. National Farmers Union is a grassroots, farmer-driven organization that believes strong family agriculture is the basis for thriving communities. NFU's membership includes over 230,000 family farmers and ranchers across America. Farmers Union's grassroots structure promotes locally initiated policy priorities and educational topics established by their members. If you're interested in learning more about NFU and the work that we do, check out our website at www.nfu.org. And finally, thank you to our sponsor. This podcast is supported by the Food and Drug Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as a part of a financial assistance award 2U01FD006921-04, totaling $1 million with 100% funding by FDA-HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by FDA-HHS or the U.S. government. I'm Catherine Cavanaugh, and this has been the Food Safety Dish. Until next time.